Shrink Wrap Radio Number 457, A Proactive Approach to Stress, with Dr. Kristen Lee Costa.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Kristen Lee Costa, licensed clinical social worker and author of Reset, Make the Most of Your Stress. For more information about Dr. Costa, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Kristen Lee Costa, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, and congratulations on your recently released book, Reset. And just as we were kind of getting to know each other a little bit before this interview formally get started, you mentioned that you've just won an award. Your book has. Tell us about that.
Yes, thank you. So I was just notified late last week that it received the Motivational Book of the Year for 2015 through the Next Generation Indie Book Awards.
Wow, that's impressive. That's really good. Because when you independently produce a book, you hope it gets noticed somewhere, somehow. So that's absolutely really, you know, there's so much competition out there. So
it's a really saturated field, to say the least. And I think that it really speaks to the fact that we're all in this context where we're working really hard, and we really need practical ways to be thoughtful about stress.
Yeah. And speaking of you as a winner, I also have to say how impressed I am by the fact that you won an Excellence in Teaching Award at Northeastern University there in Boston.
Oh, that was also just a joy and a privilege, and so humbling. I have the privilege of working with students from the doctoral level to the undergrad level, and it's just such meaningful work. They inspire me every day, and that was just such an honor because it was a student-nominated award. So I think for anyone who teaches, they know that that is the greatest form of feedback you can receive.
Exactly, exactly. Now, the title of your book is Reset, Make the Most of Your Stress. The idea of making the most of your stress sounds kind of positive. Are you saying that one can convert unpleasant stress to something more positive?
Absolutely. And I think that's the part that sometimes makes people raise their eyebrows a little bit.
Eyebrows are raised right now.
Yeah, it seems a little contrarian for sure, because I think that a lot of times there's a lot out there that's telling us that we have to either manage our stress or run away from it or pretend it's not existing. And in my research and in my practice experience, I've really learned, and as a person, that we can actually harness the adrenaline that comes with stress, so in the day-to-day stress, but also stress can build resilience, and it can actually help us to, you know, deepen our capacity to tolerate the inevitable twists and turns that life can take.
Okay, and we'll come back to that topic of resilience. That's something I'd like to talk about a little bit more, too. And I do have to say that there is, you know, given the fact that it's a book about stress and dealing with stress, there is a very positive tone throughout. So I have to congratulate you on achieving that.
Thank you.
I'm just realizing just now as we're talking about it that there is a hidden positive message just in the way that it's written.
Well, I think it's the teacher in me. And I think also, you know, just as a human being, you know, who really, you know, I love my work and I love to set aggressive goals. And I think that you, what you see in that is the fact that I've had the privilege of working with so many people coming to me for therapy. And, you know, you hear all these stories and you realize just how human it is to experience stress. And, you know, also, like I said, as a person, you know, when you're pushing hard, you can find yourself under stress. So it's a lot about being able to reframe that and to really be very mindful about the opportunities to sort of look at that big picture. It really makes a difference. So I think that, you know, we all need to be encouraged. You know, none of us are immune from stress by any stretch. And I think a lot of times we can sometimes shy away from admitting that. And you've seen this in your work that over time people have become more forthcoming about their vulnerabilities. And none of us sort of sit on that perch anymore where we say, you know, we've just arrived and we know everything and we're contained and we can handle it all well. Instead, we're realizing, you know, when we're out working hard and living life and taking risks, we're going to sometimes really, you know, need to go back to the drawing board and think about our, what we're doing or not doing that can make us either healthy or sick.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe you've answered this question already, but what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I think you're right. I think just, you know, seeing so many people's lives, seeing both sides of the coin, you know, on one hand, you know, we all can survive through very difficult circumstances and we can persevere. And that's the beauty of the human essence, right?
Right.
But then on the other hand, I've seen a lot of people, unfortunately, not be very proactive about their stress. And the thought that goes through my mind so often is I wish you had come in, you know, 6 months earlier. And, you know, we know prevention is less costly than repair. And a lot of times people, again, they live in secrecy and they're really held hostage by stress or anxiety or depression. And we know that sometimes just the simple things make a huge difference. Just a little piece of knowledge, a little understanding about self-care. And I've seen people really heal and, you know, get great momentum just by some of that basic knowledge that I think for us, you know, we can take that for granted sometimes in the work we're doing, but it's not always easy to find, you know, really research-driven and proven strategies for self-care. Mm-hmm. You know, we know a lot about physical health, but unfortunately, mental health has often been segmented, and we're whole people. We're not just, you know, either physically healthy or mentally healthy. So I think that really, it compelled me, and I wanted to, you know, be a different voice that has the practice and research grounding, but also, you know, I'm a human being who's kind of, you know, experienced my own versions of stress along the way.
Okay. There is a unique quality to your book, and you mentioned you wanted to say it in your own voice. And mm-hmm. so part of that, I think, is that you've developed your own model for mm-hmm. coping with stress. And there are five keywords in your model, and they are realize, energize, soothe, and unproductive thinking, and talk it out. Now, these words are pretty self-descriptive in their own right, but maybe you can step us through them anyway, expanding a bit on each, and then maybe we'll get into some of them even more deeper as we go along.
That sounds great. And this model actually was born back in 2008 in my clinical work. And as I said, you know, I was having a lot of people come in really depleted, and I'm a big proponent of cognitive behavioral treatment and, you know, just teaching skills and mindfulness. So I was trying to think of a way that it would stick, you know, because when someone's really, you know, experiencing a crisis level of stress or even just a moderate level, you know, you want things that really can be put into practice right away. So that word reset and that idea about recalibration and kind of the thought like, you know, we all think that sometimes, where's my reset button? What if there were one, right? And so it started in my clinical work, and then I went on to do, you know, more research and layered that in as time went on. But the first part, realize, is about perspective taking. And so we know when it comes to the literature and the landscape and stress research that appraisals matter. So when I say appraisals, think about the value of something like the worth of a ring, let's say, or our homes or our cars. When we're first hit with stress, a lot of times, you know, it's just very messy and raw and very visceral, right? And we need a little bit of time to do perspective taking and to be able to revisit that And in that revisit, which is actually known as secondary appraisal, I like to think of it like a movie set, like take two. That's a time, you know, that's a time when we can actually know what our resources are. So it might be things like internally, like our sense of humor or our sense of identity. And it might be external things like, you know, we have a great friend who will listen to us, or we have, you know, a wonderful library down the street where there's a lot of information that would be useful. So Realize is about reappraising and just stepping back and kind of buying a little bit of time so that our emotions aren't so raw.
Yeah, and to me, realizing also suggests being aware of what's going on. For example, being aware that, hey, I'm having an issue with stress here.
Yes.
You know, just noticing.
Exactly.
Yeah, so let's see, what's the next word here? Help me out. I had it in front of me and now I'm
not. No worries. So it's energize.
Energize. How could energize. I forget that?
And again, it's very self-explanatory. So energize involves the ways we're taking care of our body, you know, and our mind and spirit, of course. But, you know, a lot of times people think about, when I think about energize, I think about things like exercise and sleep and nutrition. And, you know, a lot of times when people think about exercise initially, they think it's about fitting into their jeans. But there's a great slogan that says, running is cheaper than therapy. And we know movement, you know, from all the brain research and just everything we know, actually facilitates better mood and better focus and better memory. So when we're moving our bodies, you know, that's a great way to reduce anxiety and depression and just get us to move through problems we might be stuck on.
Yeah, well put. I've actually been dealing with a situation in my own family. I don't want to go into a lot of detail about it, but a member of my family has been suffering from a lot of anxiety recently, and we've been going on long daily walks, which is beneficial to both of us, doing about 5 miles a day.
Terrific.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And it does seem to help, yeah.
It really does. And, you know, Tom Hartman he wrote this great little clever book called Walking Your Blues Away, and it's kind of an oldie, but I love the whole neuroscientific bent on it, you know, and he was just saying that when we're moving our bodies, we're able to process through problems in new ways because of that bilateral movement. So it's like both sides of our bodies are moving, and that facilitates both sides of our brains moving, which really is helpful.
Yeah. So
I really believe walking is a huge recalibrator.
Yeah, right. Me too. What about the word soothe? That's another one of your key words, S-O-O-T-H-E.
Yes. So soothing, you know, I think our senses, you know, if you were to Google stress reduction or management or any of those words I don't love, you'd find a lot, obviously, about, you know, all kinds of things, but maybe not so much about our senses. And I think we forget, especially if we're those high adrenaline people and we have a lot of people we're taking care of and a lot of tasks on our list, we forget that our brains and bodies are constantly getting that message, you know, of hypervigilance, we're on alert, something's wrong perhaps, and we don't realize that our senses are really taking things in a certain way that can be really impactful on our health. And so soothing is about, you know, mindfulness and intentionality and being very deliberate about either maybe making changes in our sensory environment. So let's say, for example, as a simple example, things are really cluttered and we clean it up and that just feels a little bit better.
Oh, that's me. Like if things are cluttered, I don't feel good.
Because our brains are cluttered enough, right?
Yeah.
And it's overstimulating. And I think that's the key thing is that we find ourselves overstimulated very often and then we don't take things in. So I'm very guilty of kind of gulping my food down fast. I noticed that recently, and I've made a change because I was so busy. Sometimes I'd eat at my desk or running around on the go, and I'm not really even just enjoying the beauty of the food and the nutrition and the nourishment that's bringing to my body. So what I assert is that we're either going to soothe adaptively or maladaptively, and that's really going to impact our health bottom line. And I think we see unfortunate evidence of that, you know, here in the U.S. and across the globe in terms of addiction rates to food and to prescription and non-prescription illicit drugs. Our bodies don't like stress, and our instinct is to bring that level down. And again, just think of our senses, our sight, our hearing, our touch, our taste. We need to be soothed in really helpful ways. And it's something to really pay attention to. And again, I think a lot of people forget that we end up being overstimulated constantly instead of just at ease.
Some years ago, I was in a workshop that a friend was putting on, a body therapist kind of workshop. And he used the term self-soothing. And in a way, it was kind of a new concept to me because realizing, I think we did things like put your hand on your own body, you know, put your hand on your belly or put your hand on your heart or give yourself a hug.
Yes.
And these are so basic.
Yes.
But doing that with a kind of a soothing intent actually, I think, has an immediate impact.
I think so, too. And I love the way you just put that. And the way I think about it is the before, during, and after with soothing and any of these types of principles. You know, say you're going to have a lovely walk with someone, you know, you kind of talk it up in your mind and say, you know, this is going to be great. In an hour, I'm going to go enjoy this walk. And then during the walk, you're saying, wow, look at that beautiful tree or that beautiful sunset. And you take it in and you're intentional and mindful. And then later you might even remind yourself, you know, today might have been very stressful, but I had that walk and that was a great way for me to reset and to feel well. So I think that reinforcement of the senses really matters too. And like you said, it's simple. It might just be putting your hands on yourself or, you know, someone you love doing that for you and taking that in. It really helps.
Okay, now the next key word here is unproductive thinking, but it's supposed to be an E, isn't it? Where's the E in there?
The E went away, I guess. So it's end unproductive thinking.
End it. Yeah, bad notes on my part. End unproductive thinking.
No worries.
Yeah, so tell us, as a cognitive behavioral therapist, that really makes sense, but you can rhapsodize on it a little bit for us.
Sure. And I think, again, sometimes we think we have to delete negative thoughts, but negative thoughts are going to come. And this is more about learning to manage the thoughts that come in when we're under distress. And sometimes we all have those ways we default to uncertainty or, you know, just a sense of insecurity and when we're under stress. So unproductive thinking is rumination.
Yeah.
You know, and it's when we just, you know, the record plays over and over again, and we're really focused on something, you know, the negative details of a situation or a relationship, and we just stay stuck, and we spend a lot of time that isn't so productive to our health, you know, milling it over. And sometimes I'll say, you know, we fight with someone in our own mind's eye, or, you know, we have these different things we wrestle with, and it takes away. I always say, what if we could take that time we spend worrying about things that often are beyond our control or may never happen, and we were to harness that and use that towards productive endeavors. So it might be learning something new or engaging in a positive or productive activity. What would that look like? So it's being able to be aware of one's thought process and, you know, try to mitigate some of that and say, you know, wait a minute, this maybe isn't so helpful for me right now.
Yes, it goes back to your first key word of realize.
Exactly.
As you say, becoming aware that I'm stuck in some kind of a loop. And it's, you know, I've been there where you can just have this kind of unproductive rumination. Fortunately,
yes.
I've learned from talking to people like you and reading books and so on to really believe in that principle and to catch myself when I'm doing it and just to say, stop.
Yes.
And just stop it.
It's so helpful, just that simple catching oneself is so helpful. And I think, you know, it's the bright people, the people that just think a lot, you know, our minds are capable of a lot of different things and a level of analysis. And I think my theory, you know, and this is somewhat out of my research, but really from just talking to people, you know, it's the people, they don't realize that their anxiety sometimes comes because they're so brilliant. And the same thing that is their strength can sometimes get in the way and really become disruptive because their mind just wants to work so hard all the time.
Yeah.
And that's a gift, but as we know, it can sometimes, you know, have a backside to it too.
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, it's an example of you kind of putting a positive spin on it. So the more worried I am, it's just because I'm so smart.
That's right.
So brilliant.
Everybody loves to hear that. And I think just in defining smart, because I think there's a lot of people that carry this identity of, am I smart or not? I would want to avoid that. But I think we're all brilliant. We're all gifted in our unique ways. And again, if you tend to be that overthinker, sort of assess like, wow, you know, my mind is really capable of a lot and I need to sort of see if I can steer that in a more helpful direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, your last key word is talk it out, which, we're therapists. What more can you tell us about that?
Well, talk it out is about debriefing, certainly, and obviously being able to just process things out loud. But it's also really about connection. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, again, we're living in a context where there's an awful lot of disconnection to go around. You know, go out to eat on a Friday night. Everyone's texting when they're sitting at the same table. And I think that, you know, just the ability to really connect on a deep level and to find people that are able, you're able to lean into and to share, you know, the things that you're wrestling with. And, you know, I love the show Seinfeld.
Me too.
Kramer used to come in and, you know, dump on Jerry and have this whole thing. And then, you know, Jerry wouldn't say one word and Kramer would run off and say, thanks so much for your help. And I think that really shows us that sometimes a good debriefing is just so refreshing. You know, we need to be able to process things and, you know, have people that are in our corner, so to speak, and on our team. And one thing I've really learned myself is having good mentors. I've had wonderful, I just have terrific people in my life who, you know, they're a little further ahead in their trajectory and they can kind of give you their pointers and you can learn from their mistakes and they can encourage you. And I think we all need, you know, to have that wellspring of people that we can go to. And certainly it can be therapy and coaching too. Think of all the wonderful things that are happening. People are more willing to access therapy and coaching than ever. And they know that, you know, there's not a stigma like there used to be. Mm-hmm. And we can just, you know, have that objective, neutral person cheering us on and helping us with that perspective taking that's hard to do within ourselves, you know? So talk it out is really about not only some of us are more verbal than others, but it's not just about talking and talking, but it's being thoughtful about what we're sharing and who we're sharing it with, and that we're not just isolated. I think as soon as you talk to someone, you realize how not alone you are, so to speak. You know, we're all human, and we're going to wrestle with a lot of things over the course of our lives.
Yes, we are. Well, I described your model as one for coping with stress, but you described it as a model of self-care, and I like your positioning of it better. Maybe you can expand for us a bit on the idea of self-care and how that might differ from coping. They're similar, but I think there's a shade of difference.
Yeah, I think there's certainly an interrelatedness. And with self-care is really giving that careful and deliberate intention to the ways in which we're paying attention to what our needs are. And you could think of it like emotional hygiene, perhaps. And as I've said, a lot of times we pay attention to work demands and all the things we're facing. And sometimes we even spend more time taking care of our pets or our lawns or our cars than we do our mind, body, and spirit.
Yeah.
And so self-care is really about, you know, that attention to what our mental health needs are, emotional needs, so that we're not putting ourselves in a place where we're so depleted and worn out that then we become at risk for a host of health problems, including mental health. But we know physically, you know, that's sometimes the very first sign of stress is that we notice that we're having heart palpitations or we notice we're losing hair or, you know, ERs are, you know, the number one people come to the ERs, they think they're having a heart attack. And most often it's due to anxiety.
Yes.
So yep. Self-care is that it's a more of a practice. It's not like a little skill or a little tidbit or tip. It's like, what could I do every day to think about recalibration and practice that, you know, tailor and institute those practices in my life so that I'm really, you know, not putting myself, you know, at risk for ill health or burnout.
Mm-hmm. Now, you describe Reset, your book, as a new framework for self-care. So what's new compared to other approaches?
Well, one thing I'm not a big fan of is the notion that we can solve things in five easy cookie-cutter steps.
Yeah.
And so Reset is really what makes it, I think, dynamic. And the feedback I've gotten is that, you know, no matter what stage of life you're in or what your variables are, you can tailor it according to your own needs, your own preferences, your own circumstances. So it's not prescriptive in a sense like, you know, again, if you do these three things every day, you're going to feel fine. It's more about discovering what it is that is helpful to you, how you would define productive, you know, what you would find soothing, who it is that you might talk to, and then making sure that you're developing, you know, goals around that. And I think, you know, one of the key things here too, David, is this notion of motivation. And I think that that's another piece, is that it's so easy to kind of craft, you know, we have these ideals and sometimes lofty goals, like we want to set out to do these things and to feel well. We want to get more sleep perhaps, or eat better, or we want to make sure we're visiting with people that we're close with. And, you know, sometimes we establish plans that go awry because they're just not realistic. So Reset was developed, you know, again, just based on my work for so long. And for 20 years in mental health, I've learned a lot from those I've had the privilege of serving. And then, of course, from my students at Northeastern. And you learn that, again, if something's too extravagant or complicated, we won't be able to put it into play. It will be too difficult to put into action. So Reset kind of takes that in mind, that we're all pushing hard and we don't have a lot of time, perhaps. And, you know, what is it that we could adopt from this and put into play every day? So I think that, you know, that's what makes it unique or different, that it's not telling you what to do or how to do it, but it gives you a path in terms of, you know, setting something up for yourself that makes the most sense at this point in your life.
Yeah, you know, when I first got your book and looked at the title, I have to confess, I was a little wary, you know, oh, five steps, you know. Just the very thing that you articulated, another kind of formulaic approach. But in fact, as I got into it, your book is not that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's distinctive because of what I've already been hammering on, is that it's very positive mm-hmm. in its approach, even though you're talking about something that people experience perhaps as alarming. Still, mm-hmm. there's this very positive, very supportive, very non-judgmental message that comes through. And so I think it's distinctive in that way. It's probably why you got that award.
I think it might have something to do with it. But the other thing is, in my training, my training is as a clinical social worker.
Okay.
And a big tenet of our professional identity and just everything we live and breathe is about strengths-based perspective. And that's a huge message in the book as well. Unfortunately, you know, our social institutions like schools and churches and the media, a lot of times is only focused on the negative, right? And we're only focused on, you know, either diagnosing people or pathologizing them or finger pointing or blaming. And I think we all can do that too. And I know in my own development, I'm very hard on myself. And people might say, you know, you're a little bit of a perfectionist. But when you're really conscientious, you want to do well, sometimes you're going to, you know, default to that whole thing of what's wrong with me. And my ethos and my training, and obviously, you know, the whole positive psychology movement has been phenomenal.
Yes.
Is now we're looking at things from that positive standpoint, instead of saying, you know, oh, this is my Achilles heel and this is what's wrong with me. And I'm never, you know, just that kind of language we sometimes use. Instead, we can say, no, this is what's working well. And yes, these things might be true in my life. I might have real challenges, real trauma to overcome, significant difficulty and heartbreak. But yet, there's two narratives. And there's this one narrative of hardship, but there's this other of hopefulness. And that even though these things are true and I'm wrestling with them, there's all this beauty and there's all this strength to harness and leverage. So I think that really is a newer paradigm that many of us want to continue to link arms around and to be able to say, you know, we're not going to just look at what's not working so well, but we can focus on these other things. Sometimes we waste time worrying about what's wrong, and instead we're neglecting that whole other side that we could be building up.
Yeah, that really feeds into one of the other things I was going to ask you about, because in your book, you've got a phrase or a section where you talk about the pros and cons of anxiety. And yes. I think we all know about the cons of anxiety, uh-huh. but we don't normally think of the pros of anxiety.
Yes.
And What's an example of a pro of anxiety?
Well, it is. It's kind of an interesting thing that anxiety can be motivational. So let's, and we know, you know, if we're talking about stress and the definition, eustress is the kind of stress, for example, that we know athletes and performers benefit from. Think of, even if you're giving a public presentation, a lot of us get nervous in professional speaking, but you get a certain measure of anxiety and adrenaline that actually helps you to focus and to perform well. And that's true in our daily life. If we didn't have any anxiety, we wouldn't get up and we wouldn't go to work or help our families or do whatever is at hand, because we just would be so lackadaisical. So anxiety, again, if there's too much of it, it can be exhausting and overstimulating, but it can motivate us because, let's say, for example, I'm worried about, you know, I have a paper to hand in and I'm worried about my grade. Well, underneath that, my worry or my anxiety levels relate to the fact that I'm conscientious, that I want to learn, I want to grow, and I want to do well. And so I think we need to look at that. Why are we anxious, and what are the values behind it? So again, it could be academic anxiety because you value your growth in education and you want to make a difference. It could be that you're worried about your health and you're worried about getting sick, and that shows you value being a healthy person. It could be that you're worried about your child or an aging parent or someone that you really care about. And that anxiety is natural, but it reflects values. So it's another way to sort of understand that the energy or the anxiety that generates, which again, I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, can be very unpleasant and very, very unnerving, but we can look at what's behind it. And then that might help us launch into this whole, you know, way of being able to attack it and to problem solve in new ways.
Yes. Well, how about in your own life? People might think, oh, well, she's really got it together, you know, and probably had it together all of her life. Have there been any experiences that you could share here that have fed into the creation of your self-care model?
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of the big myth that we do that to one another. We sort of say, this person, especially, you know, you're in the hot seat when you're a stress and resilience expert, you know, and people will think, wow, you know, you have this research backing or this clinical work. But a big part of why I'm so passionate about this, it, like many others, you know, who have come before me, who've said, you know, these are the two narratives. On one hand, I have all this expertise. And on the other hand, I've experienced burnout and anxiety. And I say right at the beginning of my book, as I tell my story, I definitely have those traces of ADD in me and anxiety. You know, I've definitely wrestled with anxiety my whole life. And I think that's helped me to really be empathic and to really understand that, yes, that can, you know, create really difficult moments, but it can also create opportunity. And it's about kind of, again, learning oneself. And believe me, David, I practice the reset every day of my life. I anchor myself down really well because, you know, I felt that sting of too much anxiety and too much adrenaline and that sense of, you know, you can never do enough, you know, that ongoing pressure, mm-hmm. that sense of just never being able to keep up with anything and everyone. And I tell the story in my book about my own burnout, which is a complete irony. But when I was actually doing my doctoral research on burnout and coping and resilience, I was, you know, I had this whole sense of urgency. I wanted to finish in, you know, kind of a rapid time. Both of my children were in middle school at the time, and I was juggling the demands of mm-hmm. working three jobs, the academic life, and then raising the children. And, you know, what did I do? I pushed myself so hard that I started to not feel well. And I said to myself, you know, this is pretty funny in a way, but I needed to sort of step back and realize that, you know, it's really important that I practice these things in my own life. So I always debunk any myth that might come with the notion that, you know, I have it together, because every day I have to make sure I'm working towards self-care and that I'm stopping and I'm slowing down and I'm practicing these things, you know, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, Arianna Huffington's stress crash and many others, people, again, who work really hard, they've been brave and they've told their stories as well. And I think we all can relate when we're out really doing cause oriented work or just whatever we're trying to do, whoever we're trying to help or just make it through the day. we are at risk sometimes for burnout if we're not careful.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for sharing that part of your own story. And it was evoking memories in me of when I was a new faculty member. Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking around at my colleagues and all these people who were doing all kinds of things, you know, great things. Uh-huh. And so I was kind of freaking out about, I'm not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. And,
I think no matter what arena, you know, how far we progress, whatever arena any of your listeners are in, you know, you get to that point where you're maybe comparing yourself. I like how you just put that, you know, against senior faculty members. Right. And you look at their CV and you see all the articles they've published. Right. And you think, how did they do that?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's that imposter syndrome that sets in for a lot of us. Like, you know, gee, do I really belong at this table? Or are they going to find me out? Am I really good enough? And I think, again, we can all find that whenever we're sort of working our way up the ranks, so to speak, or in any circumstance, we can, you know, really feel uncertain. So I definitely relate to that, and I've experienced lots of times.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. By the way, you've got lots of sort of case history, mm-hmm. stories and examples in the book, which I think people always like to read that sort of thing. So A, I want to mention it, and B, I want to encourage you, if any come to mind in the course of our conversation here, feel free to throw them in.
Absolutely.
Now, there are a bunch of disorders that your approach can be applied to, and you mentioned some in the book, and so maybe you can speak to that, some of the clinical diagnoses, I guess, that this approach would be effective for.
Sure. And, you know, over time, I've had the privilege of working along a lot of the various spectrums. So when we think of depression and anxiety and ADHD primarily, you know, those are things that, again, people grapple with and, you know, really need that combination of strengths-based approach, you know, where they can build on their strengths and what's working well, but also address, you know, the really concentrated or intensive symptoms or situations they might be arising because of, you know, of their diagnosis, so to speak. But I also, you know, I have to say, more and more, the longer I live and the more I do this work, that the word disorder kind of makes me cringe. And, you know, I think that, you know, certainly diagnosis and intervention and assessment are very helpful things, and they can be very useful. But I think we also have to just realize that in our humanity, we're going to struggle. And so whether or not we say it's clinically significant or not, I think we can put these things into play. But certainly, I think especially I have a huge heart for people that have high levels of anxiety for whatever reason, if they chalk it up to because of a diagnosis, or if it's just because there's a lot of things at hand, you know. And we have to look at context, because again, you know, we can be dealing with divorce and death and loss at a moment's notice, you know, trauma at a moment's notice. And so I think that, you know, more than just, you know, are you on this spectrum or do you identify with this label, I think if you're a person who's just wanting to feel better and wanting to manage anxiety, you can find a lot in the RESET model.
Okay. In your book, you have a section titled Avoiding the Halt. Uh-huh. And somehow I missed any definition of the halt, although I have sort of a feel for it. But what do you mean, avoiding the halt?
Well, In the 12-step recovery communities, which have really great wisdom and they have a lot of practical things for people, there's just this very simple acronym called HALT. So it's being attentive to not becoming hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Ah. And you can see the correlation and the interconnectedness with the RESET model. It's like, again, just not letting your system go down to empty with food or sleep. You know, and if you're really angry, you know, don't overanalyze your life at that moment. And certainly being lonely or just exhausted are not good moments to appraise, you know, the condition of our lives or our strength and character. That was my Boston accent. I don't know if you caught that. That was a good Boston slip right there.
What was the word?
My character. I said character, though. Sometimes I kind of, I lose R's from time to time. So that's the Bostonian me.
Yeah. Well, Boston is a great city. Mm-hmm. I taught for 2 years at the University of New Hampshire and did a faculty exchange, and I loved Boston. And I love that whole New England accent.
There's so much charm. And, you know, I think it's funny. Sometimes it just slips out, and it's funny because I don't sound like a Kennedy by any stretch, but you can hear it. You can hear it from time to time.
Yeah. Well, why weed it out? I don't think it's anything to get rid of, personally. let's see. What else did I want to ask you here? You know, we were talking about self-care, and sometimes that comes across to some people as selfishness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, all this sort of talking about our narcissistic culture and so on. What's your take on that?
I love that you brought that out, because that's something that I find overwhelmingly people worry about. Mm-hmm. And self-care is not a selfish endeavor. But initially, I think just the words, they match up, and it just seems like the natural progression would be to say it's being self-absorbed or being indulgent or narcissistic. But we know overwhelmingly, you know, just research proves this. And again, my experiences as a person and as a professional show me that we really have to put our masks on first in order to be effective in the various roles that we're responsible for. And so it's not just, you know, running off to the spa or just, you know, it's all about me and what I need to talk about. But it's more this thoughtfulness about, if I keep my body and my mind and spirit tuned, that's going to make me more effective and more capable of being present with the people that I love and engaged in the activities that I'm carrying out at work and at home. And I think that a lot of people think it seems selfish. And I find women in particular struggle with this a lot, you know, and I think generational factors come into play. So what I found is that it's just not really part of someone's vocabulary or thought repertoire to take care of themselves. And they don't realize, I think, again, until they've gotten to the point where they're really oversaturated with stress, that they realize, you know, it would have been good if I took a little me time or I took a little bit of time to put these things into place. And they find that then they get sick, and then it becomes counterproductive, right? Because they're not able to do anything at that point if they've become stuck in the mire of, you know, terrible anxiety or clinical crisis of some shape or form. So it's definitely not selfish. If anything, you could think about it. And it's the classic airplane model thing, right? When they say that on an airplane, I always kind of look around and I think, I don't know if I could do that if I was sitting next to an older person or a child, to put my mask on first. That would seem so counterintuitive. Mm. But, you know, you have to first do that in order to sustain yourself and be effective in other ways. And I think the airplane model is that best image to demonstrate that.
Yeah, yeah. And I can see how women would be particularly impacted by the idea that, well, it's selfish. I'm supposed to be taking care of my children, taking care of my husband, taking care of my friends.
Sure.
But also, I think it's a big issue for men.
Absolutely.
Who also feel like they have to be in charge and taking care of things, and that it's not manly somehow to pay attention to your own feelings.
That's a good point.
It depends on a certain kind of man, I guess, you know, that there's a whole range of the way we men are, but definitely there's a large sample.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I
kind of like that.
It's a critical point, David, because, you know, we never want to broad brush women or men or gender, but certainly we know from the research overwhelmingly that men do wait until the point of crisis. Mm-hmm. To access help and to say, boy, I do need to attend to myself in these ways. And likewise, like you said, women, you know, there's certainly variables that come into play there in terms of identity and expectations. And for both, it's this whole thing of social conditioning, like what you should do and what you shouldn't do and what you're responsible for. And I think it creates a barrier because, again, in this context where most of us are working the equivalent of multiple jobs instead of one. I mean, we're in this culture and these market conditions of scarcity. And, you know, it's just, it's so revved up with technology. You know, we're always accountable to every email that's coming in, and there's all these pressures. Yeah. And I think that it's hard to sort of carve out the time for it. And then, like you said, those underlying things of giving oneself permission to say, you know, I do need to think about this. I do need to get, and it might be something simple, not touchy-feely, like I need to get more sleep. So I need to change something in my routine so I'm sleeping better. Because I know I'm a person, I need my sleep, because if not, you know.
Me too.
Yeah. So things like that. So it's not even, you know, it doesn't have to be this intricate emotional excavation per se of like attending to the deepest parts of ourselves, but it might be simple things that are part of self-care that actually really, really help us sustain ourselves. And I think sustainability is the key word. You know, if you think about your daily life, sometimes we have to crank, we have to really push hard, and there's just a lot of things, but how long can we all crank without hitting a wall? Mm-hmm. I ask myself that a lot, and I ask my students and those I serve in therapy too, because, you know, I just see what it's like, you know, for all of us in our respective home and work roles, and who isn't going to get exhausted and anxious and maybe burnt out if we're not careful, right?
Yeah. Oh, there's something I wanted to ask you about. Everything you're saying, my mind goes off in all these different directions, you know, that, oh, we could go here, we could go there. I'm recalling, though, that you have a section where you talk about sprinters, skippers, and tumblers. Mm-hmm. Who are they? Who are these three classes of people?
Well, that's a variation of anxiety. So sprinters, skippers, and tumblers are people that, you know, first I'll start with sprinters, kind of rushing to judgment. And that goes back to that appraisal stage, you know, the realized part. It's like that rushing to judgment. I'm just going to make an assumption really quickly. And skippers, again, might skip out on the details that are positive and only focus, hyper-focus on the negative details. Uh-huh. And tumblers are catastrophizers. So all of these actually have a lot of cognitive behavioral treatment principles embedded and kind of hidden. So the tumbler is like, you know, one thing goes wrong, and the next thing you know, it's a snowball avalanche effect. And all of a sudden, you know, let's say I fail an exam, and the next thing you know, I'm never going to have a job, and I'm never going to do this or that. I'm never going to be successful. Uh-huh. So those are all ways to think about those automatic negative thoughts that we are prone to. And we can fall into this trap of just, you know, having those behaviors where we either sprint, skip, or tumble, and we're not necessarily grounded in our thinking and challenging that initial thinking that arises under stress that isn't so helpful. And I know, like, when people read it, they say, oh, that's me. I can't believe, like, that describes me to a T. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, it describes us all to a T because, sure, again, it's very human.
Yeah. And all three, I mean, many of us can identify with all three of those at Absolutely. Various times, you know.
Absolutely.
As with everything psychological, we've mm-hmm. all got it all.
Right? Absolutely. We sure do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said we'd come back to resilience, and you talk about protective factors and resilience. Let's discuss that just a little bit. I think it's all been in what we've been talking about, but mm-hmm. if you can kind of bring it out a little bit more.
Absolutely. And one of the hints, like, I love to share with my students and with the listeners now, is that we can often look at things that we know about adolescent or child development and take the golden nuggets of wisdom and apply them for our own adult wisdom. And so I love the work of the Search Institute. They actually talk a lot about protective factors for adolescents. And, you know, what helps to build grit or resilience, and what, again, if say someone's going through, you know, significant loss or hardship or trauma, what can help them to rebound? And, you know, we know the definition of resilience is about, you know, resilience is a process of adapting in the face of hardship and mm-hmm. adversity. And it's that ability to bounce back and to regain perspective and keep trucking away, so to speak. So protective factors involve things like a sense of humor. They involve things like our family and our faith and our values and belief systems. And those things all make a huge difference. You know, just in the Search Institute, they define it, you know, like if, let's say an adolescent has some of these factors in their lives, they can really help mitigate the consequences of trauma. And we know that for ourselves through the lifespan, that when we have, you know, again, strong relationships, or when we have a sense of hopefulness and optimism and faith, or we have just a sense of humor, the ability to self-deprecate and to be able to laugh at our idiosyncrasies, that those things can help us be more resilient. If we take ourselves too serious, if we're isolated, if we just, you know, are living very selfishly or narcissistically and it's all about us, we're less apt to be resilient.
Well, let's switch focus now to some of your other activities. I understand you've been spending a great deal of time immersed in work around burnout prevention. Yes. You've even mentioned it a couple of times here. Burnout prevention and personal sustainability, which certainly seems related to what we've been talking about, but also may represent something of a new direction for you. Do I have that right?
Yes. So I've been specializing in burnout for many years in my clinical work, and now more recently in my research, in my work with corporations and schools and organizations. And that is because, you know, it was initially prompted when I saw a lot of working professionals come in to me for therapy because they were experiencing burnout. So occupations like teachers and nurses and physicians and leaders, you know, CEOs of companies, I just started to be a little bit overwhelmed by the patterns I was seeing in terms of burnout. And it made me not only curious, but really compelled to want to do something about that. And so, you know, what I've been looking at more recently is this whole notion of burnout. So I started my research efforts and my practice efforts in interventions with teachers, and specifically urban teachers who often, you know, are just dealing with really difficult circumstances and depletion of resources.
Yes.
And so, and I've extended it now, you know, to looking at what's happening in the U.S. and across the globe. And what I'm finding is not the greatest picture. And so what I mean by that is that, you know, the rates of anxiety and burnout are skyrocketing. And we're facing a crisis for two reasons. One is that one marker of this, if you will, you know, the data is showing us that one in five people are experiencing anxiety, that burnout rates are escalating, but also that our rates of illness, like such as like non-communicable disease. So we used to worry we'd catch things. Now we're worried that we're going to get sick because of obesity and because of heart attacks and stress. So we're dealing with this whole situation where, again, our market conditions are creating a situation that many of us take the bait on. We've got to work 7 days a week. Our phones always have to be on. You know, we're always competing. We're always looking to reinvent ourselves to set our mark. And at that same time where we see these rates of mental health escalating, we're actually seeing less availability of services. So we're facing what's known as a mental health crisis with critical shortage areas across the U.S. and the globe.
Yes.
So people aren't able to get the help that they need in a timely fashion. And that's really, I think, just kind of going back to what we were saying before, like what motivates me or what compels me is we need resources in our hands that are going to help us, because we're living in a time where, you know, it's been said that burnout is inevitable. And I want to challenge that and say, maybe it's not inevitable. Maybe there's a different way that we can go about this. And one, like we've talked about, might be just the pure recognition of context, that this is a context in which we're all actively battling, you know, to kind of, again, hold our ground and not let work take over or the responsibilities of family. Think of family life like people out at the baseball field and the soccer fields and dance lessons and all the things we do now for our children, in that ideal thing of being, you know, that really present parent. Mothers and fathers are under, and grandparents are under new pressures in today's times.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it's never enough, you know, with Pinterest and just all, there's so many things that I think make us feel like everything has to be perfect. And I think that's also a piece, besides the work arena, the home arena, that combination of things can really exhaust people and just leave them feeling like, you know, I got to stay up all night baking cupcakes and then the next day I've got this deadline. And you're almost in that mode where your body never comes back to homeostasis again. And so I'm really believing we need to really work together to understand burnout and how we can mitigate it. And for those of you, you know, I have sort of that researcher in me that wants to define burnout, and I can just define it kind of quickly and say, you know, it's been known as a syndrome of emotional exhaustion mm-hmm. and depersonalization and working hard, working mechanically. So a way just to explain that quickly, again, it's like we become cynical, we become, you know, robotic in our work, we become emotionally disconnected, and we just, you know, we never feel like it's enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, that exhaustion leads to a lack of presence with ourselves and with others. And think about what the implications of that are.
Yeah. I'm really thinking about how present all of this is, must be for you too, because I'm realizing that you mentioned you're a mother of two.
Yes.
So you must be doing the soccer thing and the ballet thing and the acrobat lessons or whatever, the martial arts, whatever those classes are that you've won fairies or students around to, plus yeah. you've got a clinical practice, you're teaching at a major Boston university. Mm-hmm. Boy, you've just got a lot of stuff going on in your life. So I can see that you've learned from personal experience how important it is. You say you've got daily routines for grounding yourself.
Absolutely. It's essential. And I think my story is like, you know, everyone's story, that we're all, you know, wanting, again, the best in our professional and our mm-hmm. personal lives.
Yeah.
For those they're caring for, whether it's students or spouses or partners or our children. And, you know, again, when you value wanting to give, I know my daughter's actually a freshman in college and my son's a freshman in high school. So I'm kind of coming up for air in some ways, you know, uh-huh. and you know, parenting, there's always yeah. trade-offs of stages. But it makes me see, you know, when I look at, you know, my nephews and nieces and they've got little, their children, they're just kind of out of the gate. And you say, wow, you know, the pressures just continue to escalate for all of us. So, you know, we've got to anchor ourselves down because we don't want to get sick. And I think the other thing is if we have students or children watching us in our lives, we want to model, you know, behavior that shows them how to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard because, you know, I think a lot of us can fall into that trap of, you know, we've got to do all this activity. We've got to do. And maybe we're not looking at what we need to be as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Good you know, point. Just being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was some other thought that was right on the tip of my brain that just got away. Oh, I don't want to add to your stress, but somehow I suspect that you're going to have another book. Maybe you've already started on the topic of burnout. Would that be right or not?
I won't give away the title, but it is. It has the word burnout in the title.
Okay.
So I'm actually researching again globally and here. And I really want to tell the stories. You know, I have a lot of research and a lot of data.
Uh-huh.
But I think we need to know one another's stories. And especially, again, not only what does it look like as a personal issue, so to speak, but what it's looking like as a social policy issue. And what we need to think about, because we've got to advocate, you know, organizations and companies overwhelmingly need to think differently about the flexible options they give employees and how they can, you know, treat folks in a way that promotes health, because we also know that that increases productivity and the cost of burnout and stress are tremendous on organizations and society and people. And now, luckily, a lot of people are discovering that and they're honoring that, which I think is really terrific.
Yeah. Actually, the organizational part may not be such a big new direction for you, because I noticed your doctoral degree was in organizational leadership. Do I have that right?
You do. That's exactly right. So I've spent a lot of time looking at organizational culture and dynamics and functioning. And again, my whole bent is if we can promote well-being in organizations, that can do so much to elevate people. And that's human capital, right? When we harness and leverage human capital, so much good comes out of that.
Yeah. Well, you keep doing a good job of monitoring and taking care of yourself, because I think you have just so many gifts to give the world.
And, thank you.
It's really been great to discover you and have this chance to interact with you. So as we wind down here, I wonder if there are any points that you'd like to get in that you didn't get a chance to make.
No, I mean, this has just been a delightful conversation. And, you know, one of the things I'm doing with my students at Northeastern and trying to, you know, cultivate is a conversation about this, because, again, you and I, we could have went into a lot more different directions today, sure. Certainly. And I think this is something that's near and dear and to all of us. And what I would want to leave folks with is this notion that human progress is always possible. Even, you know, no matter what we're facing, the level of anxiety or stress, it's always possible to do something and to progress. And so I've started, you know, using Instagram and using my website and Twitter to build a conversation, to build people who are really interested in instituting self-care. And so what I do on my Instagram, I take, you know, I use a lot of the pieces from my book, quotes from the book, to remind people each day, like a little daily dose of wisdom, if you will, but also to show, you know, hey, I'm a stress expert and here I am eating this healthy meal, or I'm out there jogging or at my yoga class. Huh. So I'm trying to build community with people who are interested in feeling well and being well. So if anyone wants to go to my website, I don't know if it's okay for me to share.
Certainly it is.
It's reset24-7.com. And I go by Dr. Chris. That's kind of what my students call me. They call me Dr. Chris. And I'm on Twitter at The Real Dr. Chris. And I'm also on Instagram at Dr. Chris Reset. And so I wanted to share that because, again, I thought that might be a helpful way for people to connect if they're interested in learning more, just kind of linking arms around all of this, because we can't do it alone.
Yeah, I love that image. You used it earlier of linking arms around it. So that's great. Dr. Kristen Lee Costa, mm-hmm. I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been my true pleasure. Thank you so much. Take great care.
As you heard me emphasize several times during our interview, I'm really impressed by the overall positive tone and stance that Kristen Lee Costa brings to her work. I think it came across in the interview, even though I was frequently pointing her towards speaking about diagnostic categories and so on. And in the book, this underlying positive tone and optimism really comes through. I think this is unusual and distinctive in what is essentially a self-help book. But what she does in this book is to normalize the effects of the stresses that we all face in our daily lives. And her underlying idea is that we can nip in the bud the potential negative effects of stress. In other words, we can learn to strengthen what research has shown are protective factors. She's pulled off a very nice integration of positive psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy without ever really dwelling on them as such from a theoretical point of view. This is a very practical book, and it's one that everyone can benefit from. At the same time, if the reader is in fact suffering from intense issues of anxiety, they'll find plenty here to help them get through it. After our formal interview was over, and the recording was turned off, I went into more depth about a family situation that I had alluded to in the interview. What I can share with you here is what a wonderful and empathetic listener Dr. Costa is. Even though we've never met in person, I felt very listened to and very held in her caring. So I guess what I'm saying is that she really walks her talk. And I feel really honored to have had the opportunity to interact with her. As always, you're encouraged to buy Kristen Lee Costa's book, Reset, Make the Most of Your Stress, using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar. And also, it occurs to me that I should recommend this book to any therapists out there as one to refer their patients to or to have on hand to loan to them.
Hi, Dave. This is Ofer calling from neighboring of Petaluma in Northern California. And I am the director of the Zur Institute, and I would like to share my deep, deep appreciation to your lively, informative, educational interviews. I want to let you know, not only we have used so many of them in our online courses for continuing education for mental health professionals, when I am on the treadmill, I just put my Bluetooth and connect to any of your interview at random. And sometimes I find myself, oh my goodness, an hour later, I'm still on a treadmill because I am so engulfed and mesmerized and engaged with listening to your live interviews. So thank you for providing such a fantastic resource to therapists, to educators, to the general public. So I can't wait to hear your next interview. And as you know, I'm not giving compliments very easily. And you'll be the first one to know that. So this is really, real appreciation from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Ofer Zur of the Zur Institute, who has made it possible for us to compile many of our interviews into CE course offerings. That's continuing education. I'm so appreciative of the recognition and support that Ofer and his Zur Institute have provided. Won't you please add your support for the work we're doing here by becoming a recurring donor and getting your name up on our honor roll? In fact, we do have one new supporter for our honor roll, and she is Beth Hossfield. Thank you, Beth, for taking that step. By the way, let me remind you that you can get a 10% discount on any of the courses offered by the Zur Institute, not just my courses, but all of them. Just use my discount code of DrDave88 at sign out. And Dr. Dave is just DrDave, and then the number is 88. Or maybe you're looking for career training or advancement outside of the field of psychology and so on. With another of our sponsors, Ed4 Online, you can study at your own pace and from the comfort of your own home. Ed4 Online career courses are specifically targeted to prepare for career advancement, better pay, and a more fulfilling future. They even offer financial aid. Just click on the Ed4 Online banner ad in our left-hand sidebar on Shrink Wrap Radio to go to our affiliate site where you can select from over 300 professional development courses. And be sure to use our discount code of Dr. Dave there. That's just DrDave, which will save you 10% at checkout. I've confessed here in the past that I'm a big lover of crime fiction. Go figure. And one of my all-time favorite authors is John Sanford. He's written a slew of books that all have Prey in the title. That's P-R-E-Y in the title, and revolve around independently wealthy investigator Lucas Davenport. There's a whole lovable cast of characters that evolve along with Lucas through the series. And the reader on Audible.com is as important to me as the stories themselves. The reader is one Richard Farrone. For me, his voice has come to be a key part of the John Sanford experience. My current Audible.com listen is Gathering Prey. If you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can join me in listening to this book for absolutely free, no obligation to continue your subscription, and it's your audiobook to keep, just by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hi, this is Jonathan Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, good son, Jonathan. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. I'll read just one, and it's from the aforementioned new donor, Beth, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've finally begun to donate after listening for about 8 months now. Thank you for the excellent programs you provide with top-notch guests. I'm grateful to be learning a bit more about what these leaders and developers are doing in the world of mental health and related fields. Today, I enjoyed your interview on trauma stewardship with Laura Vandernoot Lipsky. I've heard about the founder's work a little, but this program gave me understanding. Two other favorites that jump out are Mal Adoma Somme's interview, as well as Nino Burrow's PhD, and more. While I'm here, I want to mention my own organization, One Circle Foundation, which offers training and curricula on the gender-responsive circle models, Girl Circle and the Council for Boys and Young Men. Now, I should mention those all had URLs attached, but I think you can find them if you want to Google them. She goes on to say, these are transformational programs implemented locally, including Sonoma County, nationally, and in Canada, that connect, build assets in, debunk gender stereotypes with, and empower youth. My colleagues and I would love to share more with you and the listeners of Shrink Wrap Radio if the opportunity arises. Finally, a large percentage of my work focuses on children and youth, and therefore I'm hopeful that some of your interviews will provide approaches being applied to children, teens, and young adults too. Thank you for the work you do to inform and broaden us," and that's appreciatively from Beth Hossfeld, licensed marriage and family therapist. So Beth, thank you so much for that, and I'm so glad that after 8 months you were finally persuaded to become a regular contributor, and I hope others are inspired by your example. I know some listen for a lot longer than 8 months and don't take that step, so I really appreciate your taking that step. It sounds like wonderful work that you're doing, and I think it seems like maybe you would like to be invited to be a guest on the show. And so, in fact, you are invited. Just get in touch with me. And in my response to Beth, I did orient her towards one past podcast episode that I thought would be relevant to her work and that she would be interested in, and that was number 215, Archetypal Work with Inner City Youth with Kwame Scruggs, who I believe now is Dr. Kwame Scruggs. So I think I'll close with that one and wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. Remember, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Kristen Lee Costa, for her very positive approach to self-care in the face of stress. My next interview will feature return guest, Dr. Sharon Livingston. Have you ever wondered about or considered a career in coaching? Well, Dr. Sharon Livingston and her husband, Dr. Glenn Livingston, both longtime market research consultant friends of mine, and both former guests on this show, they've created a very impressive training academy for coaches. Regardless of whether that's a career you're considering, I think you'll want to know about this offshoot trend in psychology. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've got the key to the highway, feet up and ready to go. Oh, I'm listening to Dr. Dave, that old shrink wrap radio. Now when the moon peep on the mountain, I'll be on my way, listening to that quiet little voice, walking along life's old highway. Now I've got the key to the highway, got myself freed up, I've got to grow. Oh, taking to the air now, walking's most too slow. So come with me. Now, people, let's go explore the great unknown. We got the key to that inner highway. That's where we're meant to roam. So open up your hearts now, people. It's the only way to grow. Love is the key to that highway. You heard it on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.